My guest today is Seb Jensen. He is an anonymous poster, a Substack author, and a young man with quite a lot of interesting research interests, including intelligence and heritability, which we covered today in our discussion. The first half is free on here, and we cover the heritability of IQ and personality, the relationship between intelligence and fertility, the differences between men and women in terms of intelligence and achievement, shifting gender norms and the crisis of males. And this is all in the first half, which you have here. If you'd like to access the second half as well, where we cover Jewish overrepresentation, a fan favorite, the question, are conservatives stupid and liberals smart, the midwit meme, and quite a lot more. Please do head to Substack, which is alicepeschuta.com, or to Patreon/AKSubversive for the extended episode. Enjoy. Maybe we can start with, you've had a post recently about the your defense of 100% heritability of IQ and personality, which I think is quite, yeah, let's
no,
go straight
to
the...
No, it's not real.
It's not real.
Of course it's not. So
well, at least what did you mean by the whole thing?
So occasionally I like to make a schizo post, which is essentially you argue for something that's very silly to kind of put your followers on the edge, because I'm not infallible. Nobody really is. And I think that people have kind of the habit of kind of unquestioningly believing people and really they never should. And so really the point of the post was to argue that the heritability of certain traits is underestimated by the literature. And so the problems with both of the different constructs are different. So I'll go into both of them one-on-one. So with IQ, I think the meta-analytic heritability is about 60%. And the problem is that it's higher in adults. So if you look at, I think at the Dutch Twin Registry, I think the heritability is 85%. And most of them seem to congregate about around 80%. And there's a lot of arguing on whether these estimates are biased, whether it's downwards or upwards. But fortunately, there's other ways that heritability can be estimated. And you can use that identical twins that are reared apart. And so if you have, you know, two genomes that are reared in different environments, you can estimate the heritability fairly accurately. And the correlation between the identical twins that are reared apart is about 0.74, which implies a heritability of 74%. And so it doesn't seem that these twin studies are biased upwards or downwards, so they generate fairly accurate estimates of the heritability within the whole population. And then the other problem is that IQ tests aren't perfectly reliable. So you can estimate the reliability using like the internal test construction metric. That usually generates reliability about like 0.95. But if you take if you have them take the tests like during a longer time afterwards, like you take, you know, two different tests that are taken at two separate times, it's more like 0.9. And if you correct for that, that will generate an, you know, a higher estimate, but it's kind of hard exactly how that should to measure that, because there's kind of some real differences in cognitive ability across the lifespan. Like some people get injured, or their brain starts to deteriorate due to aging. And so it's not exactly straightforward exactly how that correction should be administered. And then for personality, the problem is just with the self-reporting scale. So if you take the heritability of the self-reports, it's about 50% or 40%. But when you combine those with the peer reports, it's about 80%. And that has replicated fairly well. There's two different studies that suggest that the heritability of personality traits is about 80% when you combine the self and peer reports. And the second problem is that you can't always separate genetic and environmental factors. It's usually used as an argument to advocate that heritability is like kind of like a meaningless concept, or that it shouldn't be used. But really, you can make the opposite argument. So one thing that does actually matter is educational attainment. So there is evidence, of course, that people who are more educated are have higher IQs, but of course the causality of that isn't exactly clear. And so my favorite study on this is on, I think it's Danish military exam takers. And so exam takers, they take the test at different ages and with different years of schooling. And those who have higher years of schooling, they do better on the vocabulary and the math tests, because they don't do better on the spatial reasoning or on the general reasoning test. So it's boosting their mathematical and reading abilities, but it's not really doing anything much besides that. Whereas with age, the older test takers just tend to do better in general. And that's just because they're more intelligent. And so it is true that education does boost IQ, but it doesn't actually boost intelligence. And that does seem to be corroborated by the Latin modeling. But I personally don't like that evidence due to reasons that aren't that important to get into. And the thing is that if you look at, for example, the education quality in Africa, it's obviously abysmal. Whereas if you compare that to Europe, you know, it's obviously better. But the thing is that you can't really say that the education in Africa is bad due to just environmental factors. Like, obviously, these populations different genes, and those genes are going to translate, you know, to different, you know, levels of social stability and quality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's largely my argument.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was your work or someone else's that I read that, you know, kind of looking at the heritability of intelligence in populations that were moved from sub-Saharan Africa to Europe or America is kind of cheating in a way, because the effect that you describe on environment is missing there. So it's, you could even have a heritability in way higher than 100% if you look at that. So yeah, that's what I thought, you know, maybe that's what's interesting here in your point. So what do you make of that? Is that just like shitposting or
I don't want to go into too many details because of legal reasons, but somebody told me that one of these heritability studies in Africa is actually fraudulent.
Mm.
So there's, you know, problems with fraud in like a third world of research, for reasons that I'd rather not get into. And then I think you're citing the Brian Kaplan. I don't think it was Brian Kaplan himself who did the study. He mentions it quite a few times, I think, in his book. My personal opinion is that between group heritability is kind of hard to estimate. Because obviously, if you look at, if you compare white Americans and black Americans, the difference is about 15 points. And if you look at, you know, white Americans and black Africans, the difference is about 30 points. And you could argue that's due to environmental factors, but really you could also argue that the African Americans are kind of in an artificial environment that the whites are kind of creating in terms of these social structures and whatnot. So obviously this concept of between group heritability is, I won't say it's a stupid concept, but it's a little complicated. It's not really just a straightforward number.
Mm. Yeah. And another thing that I read from you and I thought was really interesting is kind of what you see for kind of with the fertility estimates and immigration estimates and kind of the dysgenic pressures or eugenic, depending on what you see, these are different in Europe and the US. And I thought that was quite interesting. If you could talk about that a bit.
So it is generally true that minority populations tend to outbreed like the majority population. It's actually true in China. I did actually check that with the CFPS. It's true in China. I almost said a lie. The Russians are being outbred by the Kazakhs. The Kazakhs have higher fertility. In Europe, it's a little complicated. In Estonia, which is actually one of the least dysgenic countries in the world, it might be the least dysgenic, but I can't confidently say that due to the reliability of the data. The minorities are being outbred by the Estonians. So like the Africans and whatnot that immigrate to Estonia, they have lower fertility than the native Estonians. I think that in the Scandinavian countries, it's about the same. Like the immigrants who come there do have higher fertility. So the first generation immigrants, but the second generation immigrants, you know, people like me, we don't have the same fertility. We have luckily the same fertility as the Scandinavians. And then in the United States, minority groups do seem to have like constantly higher fertility than the native white Americans. I don't know that is why that is the case, but I suspect that it has to do with the overall relationship between intelligence and fertility. So if a country has no relationship between intelligence and fertility, then theoretically the minority should have roughly the same fertility as the majority, of course, but depends on the majority and minority question. In some countries, the minorities are more intelligent. That is the case in Kazakhstan, where the Russians are more intelligent than the native Kazakhs. And it's also the case, for example, like the Jews are more intelligent than the native Europeans. So of course, the concept of majority and minority isn't really that descriptive when you're talking about racial or ethnic groups. It makes more sense to talk about their genes, really. And the in terms of comparing America and Europe in terms of the relationship between intelligence and fertility, it's a little complicated because some data sets seem to have systemically higher estimates of dysgenics than others. Correcting for that is a little complicated, but regardless of kind of whatever statistical malpractice you want to do or employ, the relationship you see is that in Europe, intelligence and fertility don't relate that much. So the dysgenics are not that bad. And then in America, they do relate strongly, and that's especially true of the best data we have. I have a theory that you need to sample the population as a whole to get an accurate estimate, because if you just go to like New York or Wisconsin and you sample intelligence and fertility, they might not have much to do with each other. But if there's like a relationship between fertility and intelligence at the national level, that's going to bias the estimate either upwards or downwards. I need to do more work on that. It's understudied. And then I guess it isn't completely true that Europe has lower dysgenics than America, because there's some European country that has terrible dysgenics, really, like Romania or Montenegro for some reason.
Yeah,
like,
I'm very curious about that. Why could that be? Because I saw that in your data. I mean, I'm in Romania and Romanian. I'm very curious what it is.
I think that it has to do with development. So in our data, we found that countries with higher levels of development tend to have better dysgenics. That is, that countries that were more developed had weaker relationships between intelligence and fertility. But the problem was that was also true for national IQs. So more intelligent nations had intelligence and fertility didn't correlate as much in more intelligent nations. And because between countries, intelligence and socioeconomic development correlate so strongly, you can't really tell what's driving the relationship. So theoretically, if intelligence and fertility relate, over time, the average intelligence should fluctuate because, intelligence is heritable. The additive heritability, which is what's important here, is about 60%. So you kind of have to regress these estimates downwards. And theoretically, you should see countries with worse dysgenics over time have lower IQs. But the problem is that these relationships can fluctuate in time, and it's, not exactly clear whether these relationships held up in the past. Most of this data comes from like the 1950s to 2000s. So it's fairly recent data. You can't really extrapolate it to the past. My personal theory is that it's obviously true theoretically that more dysgenic countries should over time have low IQs. And there's also research from totally different people that suggests that as countries undergo the fertility transition, status and fertility don't correlate anymore. So I think it's a book that was released last month that Emil Kirkegaard sent me. He sent me it because it corresponded to my research. And they found that countries with high levels of fertility that hadn't undergone the demographic transition yet, they had negative relationships between status and fertility. And so as they underwent the demographic transition, those relationships started to disappear. And within populations, of course, status and intelligence do correlate, but they don't correlate that well. So if you look at permanent income and IQ, the correlation is about 3-4. It's lower if you just take 1 year because, income can fluctuate a lot, between years. You have to end up all of the years to generate a reliable estimate. And for education, it's about 0.6, but that's kind of, the thing is that education is kind of sorting people based on intelligence already. So I don't like to use the, you know, the correlation between IQ and education as kind of like a justification for why IQ is important. It's kind of like a circular reasoning, basically, because, you know, education is already sorting people for intelligence, if that makes any sense. And it is true that between countries, if there's a relationship between educational attainments and fertility, usually that will translate to a relationship between intelligence and fertility. But the correlation between these two vectors is only 0.65. There's a downwards bias because these vectors are unreliable. It's not exactly clear what the true correlation is because of that. And let's see, where was I? Oh yeah, in terms of why more developed nations tend to have like weaker correlations between status and fertility or intelligence and fertility, I think that it's because these nations offer more opportunities to wealthy or competent people to kind of build up their incomes and their like estates and whatnot and have children. And of course, it's true that between countries, like wealthier countries have less children. But I think that if you look at like lottery studies, or there's even like studies that assess like the effect of like housing prices on fertility, there's a small causal effect of wealth on fertility. But the thing is that the effect is so small that, you know, between countries, the relationship is actually negative. So wealthier countries have lower levels of fertility. And in terms of the actual strength of the relationship, you can estimate the projected decline in intelligence using the Breeder's equation, if you have both the fertility and intelligence factors, and an estimate of the additive heritability. And what I find is that I don't think disjunctions are that much of a problem. And so they might be a problem within like some undeveloped countries and within the United States because the relationships are so strong. But within Europe, the projected decline in intelligence is about 2 points per century. And that could easily be overridden with like embryo selection. So if even like a small, you know, proportion of the population is selecting embryos for intelligence, that would be enough to completely override the relationship. And then within the United States, it would probably take more effort, but I think it could be done to reverse this disjunction for the embryo selection. And I forgot to say what the decline in America was. And the projected decline in intelligence, based on the Breeder's equation, is about 4.5 points per century, which is a little concerning, but I don't think it's impossible to overcome at all.
I think
that a lot of people who study these kinds of like decline topics like AI or climate change, they have a tendency to like say that, oh, we're all going to die, or that there's going to be a complete collapse. And I think that's kind of, I think that these kinds of decline and collapse theories, they appeal a lot to kind of neurotic and narcissistic people. The neurotic people will kind of be overwhelmed by their negative emotions and all of the information, that they'll just naturally conclude that, you know, everything is going to end and whatnot. And it appeals to narcissists because they kind of have the, you know, the secret key information that, oh, this is all going to end. And, you know, it's kind of almost like an initiation, right? I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of religions have like collapse theories and stuff like this.
Yeah, I think that's a good theory. And I think there's just something to the nature of the internet and kind of how, you know, community is formed and how kind of, you know, people coalesce around info hazards. And, it does kind of push you a little bit into more neuroticism and more narcissism as well, because it's, you know, it's both a mirror and a, a net, like a broadcasting platform. So yeah, it's definitely not a good trend there. Let's see. I had something
forgot to bring up something. Sure. So some people think that the decline is underestimated because of mutational load. So there is strong theoretical evidence to think that mutational load induces lower levels of intelligence and lower levels of values and other traits like heights, even like political views and whatnot, like they tend to become more leftist. But I think that the magnitude of this effect must be very small. And the reason for this is that if you look at across time in the United States, the actual, you know, reading ability and mathematical ability of students has not changed at all for 50 years. And it is true that they're getting shorter, but I think that's because of Hispanic immigration. That seems to be the obvious cause of that. And then the other problem is this meta-analysis. It's an extremely large meta-analysis of memory. And over time, I think that backwards digit span did decline by about 2 points, but forward digit span increased, actually. And it's true that because of the Flynn effect, IQs are going up across time. But the problem with the Flynn effect is that these gains don't pass measurement invariance. So it's possible to test using models whether these gains in IQ are due to kind of like a general increase or just some kind of psychometric bias. And what they consistently find is that it's just due to bias. And that when you correct for this bias, there's no gain at all. There is some theoretical evidence to think that there was a real increase. For example, like brain sizes have increased in the past about 100 years due to, you know, gains in nutrition. And that should translate to a gain in IQ. But of course, that you have to take into account like the dysgenics and whatnot. It's very difficult to actually know whether, you know, the ancients were more or less intelligent and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I wanted to bring up.
No, I also remembered what I wanted to say. You know, at the country level, isn't it the case that what's most important is kind of the smart fraction and kind of dysgenics in the wider population is attenuated by the fact that if you can cultivate, maintain, and maybe enhance your smart fraction through whatever technologies appear, that's mm-hmm. more consequential than whatever the average IQ is.
So there is some decent theoretical and circumstantial evidence to think that smart fractions do matter. So for example, if you look at South Africa, South Africa's average IQ is about 75 or so, but they obviously have a large smart fraction because of the white population. And South Africa seems to be a lot more developed than the rest of Africa. You know, that's kind of like a wild coincidence, but it really could be just a coincidence. And there's also studies that try to see if the smart fraction residuals predicts like economic development after you control for the average IQ. The answer is that they do. But the problem I have with these studies is that I think that it's a lot easier to estimate the smart fraction. Because a lot, you know, the smart fraction values, they don't actually come from IQ studies. They come from student assessment studies. And theoretically, it's kind of easy to manipulate the results of these studies by like excluding immigrants or excluding students that do poorly or excluding students who are from like lower status backgrounds. And that's going to shift the mean, but it's not going to really shift the smart fraction. And so I think that it's just kind of easier to compute the smart fraction because of that. So I don't think that's really a good argument for smart fractions mattering. So fortunately, I don't have a position on the whole smart fraction question. I think it's too understudied at the moment.
Yeah. Another kind of common idea that I hear kind of vehiculated all the time is, you know, the greater male variability. I mean, is that borne mm-hmm. out by the data that you've seen? Because at the same time, I think I've read a few points where people were a little bit skeptical about the sampling. Mm-hmm. There's not a huge amount of studies geared towards discovering this. It's just essentially kind of an artifact of data that's already been collected. So I wonder what you think about that.
So in terms of sex differences in intelligence, it's a controversial topic. Publicly, most researchers think that there's no difference. I haven't asked people about it privately, so I really can't, you know, if that's just, you know, like a private-public difference or whatnot. In terms of variability, I think most agree that there is a difference in variance. So the males have more high IQ participants and lower IQ participants. I think that the best evidence for this is in the Project Helen dataset, where they have, you know, this large amount of subtests that were collected. And it seems that in basically every single subtest, the men vary more. And it's also true for The tests were men out score women. So if you have, you know, all 28 subtests, at the subtest level, the subtests where the men score the best, they also have a higher levels of variance. It's a little strange. And it seems that I actually did test greater male variability behind the scenes in the Wisconsin longitudinal study. I didn't actually find it, but I think that's because on this particular test, the woman scored better. But it kind of plays into the whole difference theory, I guess you could call it. And the second part is, of course, the difference in the means. On average, the men do outscore women on IQ tests, but the difference is quite small. It's like 2 to 4 points. And it does vary by the test on that. I think it's called the Henman-Nelson test. The women outscore the men. I looked at it in the Wisconsin data. And on the GATSBY, which is a study they use to evaluate employees, the women also outscore the men. The most tests, like the ASVAB or the Westler, the men do outscore the women. The reason why there's so much variance and differences is because the subtest differences are quite large. So there's some tests like a mechanical reasoning where men outscore women by like a whole standard deviation. And then that shifts the average estimate quite a bit because of that. But there's also some tests where women outscore men by a decent amount. Like I think on spelling test, it's like 0.3 or 0.5, the difference in terms of standard deviations. And that's also true for processing speed. So women can process information more quickly than men. The difference is about 0.3 of the standard deviation as well. And because of these large subtest differences, the overall difference will be biased heavily by what subtests are included in the actual test. So it's very difficult to know whether there is an actual general advantage from in terms of men versus women. Personally, I think there probably is a difference of about 2 to 4 points. It's difficult to tell. And it's also not clear whether that also translates to a difference in general intelligence. So I think there's some Latin studies that suggest it doesn't. So if you like model intelligence as a Latin construct, and you calculate the difference between men and women, in that Latin model, the difference is just zero, which is odd, but I guess it's still possible. And some people think that these differences in intelligence between men and women could contribute to large differences at the tails of achievement. So it is true that prominent figures like scientists, artists, and whatnot tend to be overwhelmingly male. Charles Murray actually tested this in the Human Accomplishment book, and he found that 98% of eminent people were men. So people think that they might be biased by the fact that they want to include more men on these lists or whatnot. And one way that Murray tested this theory was that he took prominent female scientists who were not on his list, and he tested the amount of men who had biographies that were as developed or more developed than these women in a database of scientific biographies. And consistently, if he found that there was like one prominent female scientist who was excluded from this data set, he could find like 60 to 120 men who had biographies that were just as good as these women, just as long. But they were also just excluded just because of, ways statistics work. And what I mean by that is that the way that Murray calculated these eminence indicators here, this, large data set of eminent people, is that he took like this giant database of scientific rankings, so like, top scientists, top artists from different nations and whatnot, and he computed an index of eminence, based on how highly these people were considered on these lists. I'm not sure how many eminent people he put on the list, but there, must be a cutoff somewhere, right? But the location of the cutoff does not seem to probably have affected his results. Because, you can just find so many, I'm tumbling over my words a bit. But what I'm trying to say is that, there's some female scientists who were just excluded from his list because of his methodology. But the thing is that you can just find so many different men who are also excluded. And the proportion seems to be about the same as the one that he found in his data, which leads me to believe that is simply true, that there are a lot more eminent men than eminent women.
Yeah. I think that's indisputable. I mean, just, you know, just observing reality. I wonder, you know, there are some facets to this that I think are just harder to kind of operationalize. Like, for example, differences in interest. I mean, that's a bit harder to measure. I could imagine difference in competitiveness, difference in maybe resistance to pressure, you know, seeking out, things like that. I'm sure there are ways to put this into a graph, but I think it's just a little bit harder to, to imagine.
Yeah, so I think that it is true that if you look at differences in interest, men have kind of more autistic, quote-unquote, interests, like they like technology or science more. But I think that it's kind of difficult to estimate how large this difference is just using self-reported surveys. For what it's worth, if you actually try to statistically model male and female distributions of intelligence, even if you like take a quote-unquote sexist model that has a large amount of variance and like a decent male advantage of like 3 points, you can't explain the male advantage in eminence just with a difference in intelligence. So it's possible to do this if you know what the average IQ of an eminent person is. And it's kind of hard to estimate, but I think Anne Rowe, she did test the IQs of eminent scientists, noblists, and whatnot. She found an average IQ of 152, which seems pretty plausible to me. So it's close to the value that I used, which was 145. And the reason why I used a lower value was that theoretically the average IQ of prominent scientists should be higher than the average IQ of like prominent artists, statesmen, and whatnot. But of course, that's kind of difficult to test using data because they haven't really tested the IQs of famous artists or statesmen. And if you were to estimate using a model that has a difference of IQ in men and women of 3 points, and an advantage of variance of 1.2 standard deviations, you would expect 79% of the people with IQs of about 145 to be men. But the problem is that 98% of the eminent figures are men. So that obviously can't explain the discrepancy. Personally, I think it's due to just social factors. I think that's actually the largest source of the difference. It's a bit of an odd take. But a funny thing is that if you actually look at studies of genius, like the one that Sherman did in California, they collected the IQs of several different children who scored above 140, I believe, or 130, if not exactly sure what the cutoff they used was. But we found that a lot of these highly intelligent women just decided to become homemakers. And obviously, if you become a homemaker, you can't really become a prominent scientist. It's just a lot of stuff to juggle, you know. So I think that like social norms do play a role in these differences.
Yeah, I think social norms and just like I said, interest. You know, like for example, I think there's a huge discrepancy in chess, and also a huge discrepancy. Like I think there were these studies where women and men kind of scored similarly in kind of math Olympiads, but then if the women had like an equivalent verbal IQ or maybe, you know, similar to their, you know, spatial mathematical reasoning, they tended to, you know, still gravitate towards arts and letters and things like that, and not make use of their maybe equivalent capacity to, you know, do whatever spatial reasoning. So I think, yeah, there's just definitely some temperamental social aspects that kind of flow into that. There's another article that you wrote I thought was really interesting. It's about the crisis of males, and you kind of looked at all the data that relates to, you know, the loneliness crisis, sexlessness, friendlessness in males. And I mean, this was not talked about maybe 10 years ago. Now it's quite talked about, especially on the right. I wonder what you found. I mean, I have a whole list here. Maybe we could go through a few of these, because obviously, you know, I don't know if you have the data to hand, but you remember. You have the feeling that some of this may be a little bit overstated because it's not really borne out by the data. I think it's
completely overstated.
Okay.
So it is true that men do seem to be underperforming certain markers. If you think of them, the men who are born in generations past. But the problem, the problem I don't have is, you know, with the fact that men, contemporary men are underachieving. The problem I have with the narrative is that they try to, you know, focus on men specifically when really, if you look at both sexes, both of them seem to have be having problems in the modern day. So it is true that difference in economic status between men and women is closing because of, you know, gender norms and whatnot. They're shifting over time. But the problem is that that doesn't seem to be translating to psychological differences. So it is true that young men commit suicide about four times the rate that young women do. But the problem is that I think that relates to psychological differences, like just innate ones. Yes, innate ones. And if you look at the difference over time, the sex differences in suicide seem to be closing, which is a little alarming, actually, because it's being driven by young women committing suicide more than their generational peers in the past. And it isn't true about Germany, though. So in some countries, it is true that the sex difference in suicide is closing within the younger generation, but it isn't true about Germany specifically, and I don't know why that's the case. It's a little odd. And so there's also the depression data. So it is true that teenagers seem to be getting increasingly more depressed. Like Jonathan Fite has good work on this. But the young men and young women seem to be increasing in depression at either the same rate or what you actually find more often is that the young women are getting depressed faster than young men, which is kind of incompatible with this whole male struggle narrative. Really what the narrative should be is that people are kind of becoming more depressed and anxious in the younger generation. And that's true for both men and women.
I hope you enjoyed this shorter version of the Subversive Podcast. For the full version, for the full archive, and for pretty much everything I've written in the last 3 years, please do head to the Substack link in the show notes, or to Patreon if you just want the audio version of the podcast. Thank you so much for your support. This is literally what keeps the lights on, the sparkly, twinkly lights that I got for the podcast, and puts food on the table of my children, multiple. So thank you so much for your kind support, and see you next time.